This Thursday and Friday evening at the Tennessee Theater, the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra, along with the Knoxville Choral Society and the Webb School of Knoxville Chamber Singers, will perform Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and other works. I sat down with conductor Aram Demersian to discuss Beethoven's timeless Ninth Symphony. To put it into pop terms, Beethoven's Ninth to me is like Hey Jude by the Beatles. It's going to be around forever. Do you think that Beethoven, when he was writing that piece, had a sense that this was going to be an immortal piece of music?
That's a really good question. It's always tricky to get inside the minds of composers who, you know, died centuries ago. But actually, that is kind of what we're trying to do when we're taking these timeless pieces of music and performing them again and trying to develop new and personal interpretations. I think that Beethoven knew that he was doing something that had never been done before. Nobody had ever added a chorus to the end of a symphony. He was expanding the symphony. He was pushing the symphonic form past any extent that it had been pushed before. I mean, the last movement alone, it breaks all of the standards. I mean, you know, there's even text in the Ode to Joy that talks about, you know, what the customs strictly divided. Now, he was talking about equality and class distinctions when he was saying that, but he also completely broke with the customs of what symphonic writing was. So I don't know if Beethoven thought that what he was doing would have quite the staying power that it did. I don't know if he would have predicted that it would have been used in so many historical contexts and situations, 200 years later now. I mean, even on that premiere program, he had programmed before the Ninth Symphony three movements of his Missa Solemnis, which at that time he claimed to be his finest work and probably thought was going to be the most timeless out of anything that he had ever written. But I don't think that you can possibly anticipate the staying power of a Beethoven's Ninth. But I do think that Beethoven knew that he was doing something important when he composed it.
Why do you think it's such a timeless piece?
So many reasons. You know, it speaks a little bit to my conception of this entire program. This program to me is about anthems and why we sing them, why they resonate with us, why we feel powerfully about them, why certain ones endure over time. In the case of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, I think on some level it endures because it is such a simply yet elegantly written anthem. It's something a child can sing. Bum 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 ba da dum. It's just outlining the first five notes of a D major scale. Yum bum 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 ba da dum bum bum ba da dum bum bum bum. Yeah, I mean, Beethoven does this so much. Is he takes this material that say it's not much really, you know, dun da da dun 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 da da dun 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 da da. You know, but he turns it in to something glorious. And you know, anthems are one way that we enter into a community. So on some level, the Ode to Joy is an entrance into a musical community. I mean, you look at Suzuki Book 1 that any violinist plays, the Ode to Joy is somewhere within the first 10 pages there. But then you also take the subject matter of the Ode to Joy, and it is really all about entering into being part of a community of humanity. And I think that Beethoven's ideals of equality, of universal brotherhood, are issues that, you know, clearly you can even see in the news today, are issues that humanity continues to return to. And in the case of when Beethoven wrote the Ode to Joy, there was happening in Europe at the time a period of restoration of despotism, essentially, which went against Beethoven's Enlightenment progressive ideals. And so in the case of the Ode to Joy, he was somewhat writing it as a response to the situation in the world at the time. And really, invoking anybody that's listening to it to continue to strive for our highest ideals. When, you know, when he says, "Seid umschlungen Millionen, diesen Kuss der ganzen Welt," be embraced, you millions, this kiss is for the whole world. And when he says, "Alle Menschen werden Brüder," all men will become brothers, he's not saying this in a valedictory way necessarily, he's saying it in an aspirational way. And I think our societal aspirations and our human aspirations toward this ideal of equality are, you know, it keeps coming back to us because it's an ideal that humanity has never reached before and one that I think most of us hope to continue to strive for.
And joining you on this weekend's performance, you also have the Knoxville Choral Society and the Webb School of Knoxville Chamber Singers. I can only imagine what it might be like for a high school student to get to participate in something this big and glorious.
Yes, you know, never enough voices for Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Absolutely never enough voices. And, you know, when we thought of the idea of featuring a high school choir along with the Knoxville Choral Society, I leapt at it the moment it was just a seed of an idea, because I was a high school choral singer when I was younger, and it's a very special, powerful experience to be on stage with a symphony orchestra to begin with, but also with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Your first Beethoven's Ninth experience really sticks with you, and I think that we're going to be creating a very powerful memory for all of the students in the Webb Choir. I also don't want it to go overlooked, though, that there will be on stage with the choir students from the Tennessee School for the Deaf. There will be 8 students from TSD there signing the Ode to Joy, or performing the Ode to Joy, in American Sign Language. And I've been looking for a way to collaborate with Tennessee School for the Deaf ever since I learned about their presence in our community, and in the case of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the ultimate inclusive piece, a piece that Beethoven was deaf when he composed, and even though he conducted the premiere, he never actually really heard a note of it. It just seemed to me to be a very harmonious thing to do, to include School for the Deaf students and creating this lasting memory for them as well.
So this program has maybe the anthem and then some anthems that aren't as well known. Jesse Montgomery's Banner. Can you tell me a little bit about that? And the banner refers to the Star Spangled Banner?
It does indeed. Yeah, Jesse Montgomery is a New York-based composer who I really, really admire. I'm a huge fan of her music. And this was the first piece of hers that I learned. She wrote it in 2014 for an organization called the Sphinx Ensemble. And the Sphinx Ensemble and the Sphinx Foundation is an organization dedicated to promoting and supporting greater diversity in the classical music world, and particularly supporting young classical music artists of African-American and Latino-Latina descent. And this piece was written in 2014 as a tribute to the 200th anniversary of the composition of the Star Spangled Banner. And Jesse takes a really insightful approach to doing this. She basically poses the question, what does the Star Spangled Banner, and, you know, just what does the idea of patriotism mean, and what does it look like in our truly multicultural society of the early 21st century? And she does this by basically using the melody of the Star Spangled Banner as source material for this piece. I think she calls it a rhapsody on the melody of the Star Spangled Banner. The piece is for string quartet, solo string quartet, plus a string orchestra backing it up. And it really breaks down into 3 parts, which are, you know, it's absolutely fascinating. The first section is really just kind of, a true just rhapsody on the melody, takes the melody, breaks it down into different sections, layers it on top of each other, almost like in an Ivesian treatment, and almost similar to what Ives might have done with Variations on America. The second section is a dirge-like section that has the violas and the basses imitating almost the drums that you would hear I don't know what Jesse was imagining, but it almost conjures up a military funeral to me. And then over this, you have the solo string quartet playing a musical outlining of the Pledge of Allegiance. So you will hear them play ba 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 ba. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And that is what outlines the second section of the piece. And then the third section of the piece actually kind of gives you what the source material for the whole piece beyond the Star Spangled Banner is. She's very cleverly reflecting the multicultural nature of our present American society by weaving in other anthems, reflecting that, you know, within this Star Spangled Banner that represents our collective Americanness, there are so many other tunes and songs that represent who we are or who our fellow Americans are. And there's this moment in the right before the finale of the piece where she layers the Star Spangled Banner with Lift Every Voice and Sing, with the National Anthem of Mexico, with the Anthem of Puerto Rico, with a worker's song from Cuba, with Cumberland Gap, very relevant to our region, and also along with This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land. It's a very, very powerful statement, I think, and a very thought-provoking statement, and I think a very inclusive statement. And I want to say it in Jesse's words, because she puts it much better than I ever could. She said upon writing it that in 2014, or I'll say in 2019 now, a tribute to the U.S. national anthem means acknowledging the contradictions, leaps and bounds, and milestones that allow us to celebrate and maintain the tradition of our ideals. I think that's one of the most patriotic messages that you can communicate. And I think also this idea of striving for our ideals, recognizing where we are and recognizing the work that we have to do to reach our ideals, dovetails very nicely with the spirit of Beethoven's Ninth as well.
This piece really captured my imagination. I've been listening to it over and over. And one of the things I love about it is it's so ambitious in its what it's trying to do, but it's so compact in its execution.
Yes, it is. It's a little bit under 9 minutes long. At times, it's like a musical fireworks show. There's an electricity that's running through the entire piece, and you can enjoy the piece of music without knowing everything that I just explained about it, without knowing all of that context. But I just think it's so much more exciting when you can track some of what she might be weaving together. And there are so many layers to it, and I haven't uncovered all the layers yet. I've never actually gotten to talk to her about this piece. I don't want to until we've gotten the chance to perform it, because I want to see what we discover about it on our own before maybe giving the decoder ring.
About 6.5 minutes into it, there's a moment in the performance I watched where everyone stomps their foot on the ground. Like,
yes.
Do you guys do that?
Oh, yeah.
Do you stomp your foot as well?
I will be stomping my foot as well, yes.
That's actually a really incredible moment in the piece, because I don't see it coming, you know. Even when I know it's coming, I don't see it coming.
Yeah.
It's such an exciting little moment.
Orchestras can do a lot more than play their instruments. You come back to the May Masterworks, you're going to hear the orchestra singing as well.
Also on the program is Mark Harrell's Time Like an Ever-Flowing Stream, a really beautiful, kind of a sad piece. How does that fit in with this anthem theme?
Well, the text, Time Like an Ever-Flowing Stream, is drawn from a very famous anthem, a very famous hymn text, the text by Isaac Watts, O God, Our Help in Ages Past. And the Mark's piece is not so much inspired by the overall hymn itself, but mostly by this one line about time as an ever-flowing stream. And it takes that line and creates a musical aesthetic that has very much a flow to it. And this fits in a few ways, I think, to the conception of the program. So one thing that interests me about the Ode to Joy and the Star-Spangled Banner, they were only written 10 years apart. So I mean, it's really fascinating to just think about how both of these are kind of coming out of the same moment in our world's history, and they both continue to resonate over time. And the fact that they resonate even in our present day, 200 years later, I thought that there needed to be some type of piece that kind of connects the present to the past in the structure of our program. And then also, when you consider the text to O God, Our Help in Ages Past, it is also espousing a type of equality and a type of unity that transcends nations, that transcends present conflicts of the moment. There are two lines from the hymn, really, beyond the one that was the title, that really resonate with me. All nations rose from earth at first and turned to earth again. And then the busy tribes of flesh and blood, with all their lives and cares, are carried downward by thy flood and lost in following years. Time, like an ever-flowing stream, bears all its sons away. They fly forgotten as a dream dies at the opening day. Basically, ultimately, we all come from the same place and we're all going to the same place, whatever your interpretation or system of belief of that place is. And I think that that's just another way of looking at this idea of what have you, universal brotherhood, equality, the land of the free, the home of the brave, and all of the different meanings that words like that can take on depending on what your experience is, what your identity is, what your self-identity is. You know, I want everybody to be able to hear this program and take its meaning for whatever they personally identify with, but also recognize that it's a mechanism for empathizing with somebody else's experience.
It's a really wonderful program, how the pieces sort of balance out each other. I know that when Mark Harrell was writing this piece, he was losing his father. And so you have this whole thing of impermanence, yet you have these pieces that survive probably as long as anything will.
That's why we make music, really. You know, it's why we make music. It's to be able to communicate both in the moment and long after we've let these pieces of music go. I mean, with any piece of artwork, I don't know how composers do it. With any piece of artwork, there becomes a point at which that artwork is no longer yours. Once you've completed it and once you have either put it in the hands of a performer or displayed it somewhere and it's subject to the interpretation of others, the artwork becomes the province of many, of a community. And I think we can see that, of course, in Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And we have these two pieces by living composers, which have resonated over a shorter period of time, but which I think and hope will continue to resonate in the future, which is why we program new music.
And you can experience all of this yourself right here in Knoxville at the Tennessee Theater on Thursday, April 11th and Friday, April the 12th. Both programs start at 7:30. Aaron Demersian, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Todd.